WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As we begin to learn about the CIA's advances in the controversial territory of economic espionage, a new book has been published about the early years of CIA covert operations. This was the era when the CIA fought the Cold War with espionage, sabotage, and propaganda, and the agency plotted to get rid of unfriendly leaders through coups and assassinations. The new book, The Very Best Men, is about the men who led covert operations during the Cold War and about the culture they created within the CIA. The author, Evan Thomas, is Newsweek's assistant managing editor and Washington bureau chief. Thomas is the first journalist the CIA has permitted to read the CIA's own secret histories. Thomas says these classified histories were written by retired officers to be used as teaching tools so other officers could learn from the mistakes of the past. According to Thomas, there were plenty of them.
Oh, they screwed up just about everything they tried in the 1950s. They were amateurs at a professional game. Unfortunately, the other side, the communists, had 50 years of practice at running black operations, and they were better at it. For instance, we parachuted agents in behind the Iron Curtain into the East Bloc in the early 1950s. Every single one was captured or rolled up or turned by the Russians. There were no successes in this area, and they finally gave up.
Were there attempts at self-justification in these histories? Like, yes, this operation failed, but I know I was right in pursuing it.
There's a little bit of that. I mean, there is a feeling of, gee whiz, we did our best. We were up against a very difficult foe. We did the best we could. Sure, we failed, but we tried. There was a lot of that give it the old school try feeling at this time. There was also an enormous sense of urgency. We forget how scary the world looked in 1950. The Pentagon had a planning date, January 1st, 1952, for the Soviet invasion of Western Europe. I mean, we really thought the tanks were about to roll, and the feeling was, well, you got to do something. We didn't want to go to war with Russia because that meant nuclear weapons and conflagration, if not the end of the world. So the CIA was about the only thing going that could possibly stem the red tide, and we wanted to try to play the game their way by dirty tricks, by espionage and subterfuge and blackmail and bribery, all the tricks the KGB was so good at, just that we weren't quite as good as they were.
Actually, in your book, you describe what one of the plans was to prevent the Soviet invasion of Western Europe.
Well, we were going to drop all sorts of people behind the Iron Curtain to sabotage their airfields. None of that would have worked, I think. But those were the sort of plans we had. There were some, I don't want to be too critical here, because there were some good things we did. We would support these left, interestingly, you think of the CIA as being a reactionary force. It really was pretty liberal in the old days. And they would support various labor groups and student groups that were tend to be social democratic, tend to be left-leaning. They would buttress the idea of democracy against Soviet subversion. The Soviets were very busy starting their own student groups and farmers groups and labor groups. And there was kind of a war for the hearts and minds, particularly of the youth and the workers of Europe in the late 40s and 1950s. And the CIA did some constructive work in backing these front organizations. When this was exposed in the late 60s, it was all considered to be a terrible CIA plot, and how could the CIA possibly pay to subsidize magazines like Encounter or the Culture of, I think it was called the Congress of Cultural Freedom. They had various front groups. I am of the view that it wasn't such a bad idea, that there was a genuine competition, and it wasn't such a bad thing to have the West strengthen these institutions that backed democracy and freedom. That part worked pretty well. The part that didn't work was paramilitary operations, trying to foment rebellion behind the Iron Curtain, running agents behind the Iron Curtain. All that was a big mess.
Did you have an idea of what the focus of your book would be when you first started to read the CIA histories?
Really, I was looking at a personal drama here. I wrote an earlier book with Walter Isaacson called The Wise Men about the old foreign policy establishment. And when I was researching that book, that was about figures like George Kennan and Chip Boland, Dean Acheson, Averill Harriman, I became intrigued with one of their social friends, a man named Frank Wisner. Frank Wisner started the Department of Dirty Tricks. He's just the clandestine service for the CIA in the late 40s, and he later shot himself. He was a tragic Cold War suicide, and I thought, boy, I bet you there's a yarn in here. So I started looking at Wisner's life, and that led me to the life of my three other characters as well, all of whom ran the clandestine service, or in Barnes's case, in one of the cases was a deputy, but all who were prominent figures running the Department of Dirty Tricks in the early years, and all of whom shared a certain social background. They were all well-to-do, well-educated, prep school and Ivy League types, and all of whom had a very similar mindset, very confident. We can lick this. We can overcome communism. America's the greatest country, and we can do anything we want.
What connection do you think there is between the Ivy League background, the fact that there are so many people that these people hired who are former Wall Street lawyers? What connection is there between that and the types of tactics that they used in covert operations?
Well, it's incongruous in a way, and this is one of the riddles that I try to explore in my book. Places like Groton and Yale supposedly teach fair play and muscular Christianity and choosing the harder right over the easier wrong. So what were people like that doing, experimenting with blackmail, espionage, bribery, assassination? It is incongruous. And the answer lies in the enormous sense of confidence that these men felt. We had won World War II. It was exciting. It was dramatic. A lot of these Ivy Leaguers just went back to their law firms and their banks. But some of them had a great taste to do something more fulfilling and more dramatic. And there was a kind of a cowboy breed of Ivy Leaguer that could afford to stay in government service, and was attracted to the CIA, where the only weapons at their disposal to fight communism were these dirty tricks. And it was an unnatural act for them. They had all the confidence in the world to try to take on the Soviet Union, but they were using tools that they really weren't trained to use. There was a kind of naivete and gullibility amongst these Ivy Leaguers. They were not brought up to run black ops. Groton School does not teach you how to blackmail people. Working for the KGB does, and that's why they had so many failures. But they brought this enormous kind of enthusiasm and optimism and feeling that they could do anything that really was a kind of, well, the Greek word for it is hubris. They had this kind of overweening arrogance.
So whatever the spy equivalent of street smarts is, these guys didn't have it?
They didn't. A top guy in British MI6, the British Secret Intelligence Service, named John Bruce Lockhart, who was the real-world Smiley of John le Carré books, Lockhart told me that these men were innocents. He used that word, innocent. They had a kind of gullibility and naivete about them that in the end was their undoing.
Well, let me see. Do you think that the CIA involvement with the mafia in the attempts to assassinate Castro is a good example of this lack of street smarts?
The best. I mean, it's absolutely loony when you think of Richard Bissell, who went to Groton and Yale, was a Yale economics professor, a brainy intellectual who grew up in fancy drawing rooms. Richard Bissell hiring Johnny Rosselli of Las Vegas and Sam Momo Giancana of Chicago to try to assassinate Fidel Castro just blows your mind. I mean, it's way out there. And there's no good explanation for it except that Bissell was a tremendous risk taker. He thought a little bit too logically. His logic said, well, gee, the mafia are the professional hitmen. Why not hire the professionals to do this job? It all backfired. They didn't, in the end, as the congressional investigators said in the 70s when they were looking into all this, the CIA was the gang that couldn't shoot straight. They never did kill anybody. They hired the mob, but the mob killed nobody.
Did Bissell write a history that you were able to read of the CIA involvement with the mafia?
Bissell, when I came upon Bissell, he was writing his own memoirs. He had just turned 80, and he was writing his own history of what happened. I was given access to those memoirs, which have not been published yet. They will be published by the Yale University Press next year. And I spent a great deal of time interviewing Bissell as he was writing his memoirs, which was useful for me because he had just been sort of immersed in all of his past and was able to recreate it for me verbally, just telling me what he was writing.
So what were you able to learn from talking to him about the logic behind going in with the mafia?
Well, you know, it's funny. He said he had no moral regrets. He was very emphatic about that. He had no sort of chagrin that he'd done anything evil or immoral. His regret was that it hadn't worked. He felt silly and foolish that he had been duped by the mob and that the mob hadn't succeeded. As for his motivations, he said, look, I thought that people like Castro and Lumumba, two of his targets, were mad dogs. This was an urgent time. It was in the interest of the United States to get rid of these people. You know, after all, in World War II, we would have thought nothing of trying to assassinate Hitler. We did assassinate Yamamoto, the senior Japanese admiral. And it was assassination was an acceptable tool, as he put it, of international rivalry. He didn't like to use the word assassination, interestingly. He called it executive action. And there was about him, I thought, a kind of unspoken reticence about this. He claimed he had no regrets, but when he began talking about assassination, he became very formal and ponderous and rather unlike himself. And I strongly suspected that he harbored some personal doubts that he was just too stiff upper lip to reveal.
Did you learn anything new about what the plan was?
I learned a few details. One plot he told me about, and this is a bit grotesque, it was to give Sukarno, the president of Indonesia, a case of VD by getting an airline stewardess giving her a dose of bad clap, basically, and getting her to give it to Sukarno. This is all pretty crude. They never actually carried this out. It was a plan. And it typically, Bissell was very euphemistic about it. He described this plot to give VD to an airline stewardess to pass to Sukarno as a plan to biologically immobilize Sukarno through the use of a female associate.
Well,
I mean,
was there any regard for the stewardess and her health?
No. There was a double standard here. These men tended to be gentlemen towards other gentlemen. This is very British. Paul Nitze, who's an old coal warrior, explained this to me. Fair play, the rules of fair play apply to other gentlemen. He went back to the Greeks. Greeks were fair to other Greeks, but to barbarians, to their enemies, dirty tricks were perfectly okay. So it was one thing to double cross your clubmates or your schoolmates. It was quite another to double cross the Hottentots or the Fuzzy Wuzzies. The British had a long tradition of being harsh and repressive and ruthless to native tribes in Africa or in Asia or in India, and this was a mindset that the CIA leaders had as well. They were careless with third world lives.
Evan Thomas is my guest. His new book is called The Very Best Men, Four Who Dared, The Early Years of the CIA. Let's take a break and then we'll talk about the CIA some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Evan Thomas. His new book, The Very Best Men, is about the early years of the CIA, particularly covert operations. And Thomas is assistant managing editor of Newsweek, as well as Newsweek's Washington bureau chief. Getting back to the CIA and the mafia and the plot to assassinate Castro, did you learn anything new about that plot and that collaboration?
Not really. Most of that has been pretty well brought out. I mean, only in the United States would we have a full public record of the Central Intelligence Agency's darkest plots. This came about because of Watergate. After Watergate, journalists started picking up the rock that was the United States government and looking to see what was underneath. And one of the things that was underneath were these CIA plots using the mafia to kill foreign leaders. The Church Committee in 1975 did a pretty thorough investigation, and the CIA, to his credit, Bill Colby, who was then the head of the CIA, turned over what were known as the family jewels. The family jewels were all the dark and dirty tricks of the CIA, or most of them at least, over the years, and those were given to congressional investigators and for the most part made public. I learned of a few new details from Bissell. There was recently declassified a Inspector General's report from 1967 that has some more details, but the basic plots were laid out publicly in the mid-70s, and in fact are the basis now for a lot of the wacky conspiracy theories that Americans have about the CIA. Did you know that half of the people in the United States believe that the CIA had a role in killing John F. Kennedy? I think they believe that in part because of these nutty plots surfaced in the mid-70s.
Did you see any evidence of that in your histories that you read?
No, I really looked into this question because Desmond Fitzgerald, one of my characters, was running the Cuban operations when Kennedy was killed. And on the day Kennedy was shot, one of Fitzgerald's operatives was handing a poison pen to a Cuban operative in Paris for use against Castro. It was never used. Various conspiracy theorists have gone, aha, there has to be something sinister here about the CIA running all these plots against Castro and Kennedy's death. Various people have said that crazy Cubans who were linked to the mafia, who had CIA connections. I mean, there are millions of theories about this. I looked at this pretty hard. You cannot find any hard evidence. You find some tantalizing links, distant but tantalizing links, but you can't find anything that you could even begin to call hard evidence that would link the CIA to Kennedy's death. I personally don't believe it. I know the character of these men. The last thing they would do is get involved in killing John F. Kennedy. They liked John F. Kennedy. He was good to them. I suppose it's possible that the mafia did it. I suppose it's possible that sort of disaffected Cubans who had some CIA ties did it. But again, I don't think the evidence is there, Oliver Stone's movie notwithstanding.
You know, getting back to Castro for a second, there were all these attempts to embarrass him. The CIA was thinking of putting a woman's depilatory powder in Castro's shoes so that his beard would fall out. And since his beard was so symbolic, that would embarrass him. There was a scheme to contaminate the air of a radio station that he was speaking in with aerosol spray of LSD. So he'd say stupid, embarrassing things on the air and in public. I mean, looking back, I mean, do you think those schemes seem a little silly?
Well, it's even sillier. I mean, let me tell you about the genesis of those schemes. On March 13th, 1960, there was a dinner party in Georgetown. And Otsie Leiter, a well-known Georgetown hostess, had as her guest Ian Fleming, who was the author of James Bond novels. Mm-hmm. He was at work on Thunderball at the time. The other guests were John F. Kennedy, senator from Massachusetts, Joe Alsup, a famous sort of WASPy columnist in Georgetown, and John Bross, who was a senior official at the Central Intelligence Agency, very close to two of my heroes in my book, Bissell and Barnes. The conversation turned to Castro, what to do about Castro, who was new on the scene and causing trouble. And Ian Fleming, the author of James Bond novels, said, the thing to do about Castro is to humiliate him, make him look ridiculous. They believe in virility in Cuba. Make his beard fall out. Well, the next morning, Otsie Charles told me this, this hostess, she got a phone call from none other than Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, asking where Mr. Fleming was and could he come down to Langley. It may or may not be a coincidence that at just about exactly the same time, according to the CIA's own Inspector General's report, the CIA began plotting with a plot to make Castro's beard fall out by putting a women's depilatory. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Depilatory.
Mm-hmm. Depilatory is what makes your hair fall out, like on your legs or something.
Well, they were going to put it in Castro's boots when he left them outside his hotel room on a trip to Chile in the spring of 1960. Like most CIA plots, this was never carried out, but they just kept on going. The next plot was to make impregnate cigars, Castro likes cigars, still does, with an hallucinogen to make him crazy. And the next idea was to put a poison in the cigars to hand out those cigars and various other pills and potions. Richard Bissell hired the mafia.
So you think it's possible that some of these dirty tricks are actually inspired by the creator of James
Yes.
Bond?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's hilarious, but I think Yeah. No doubt it's true.
Your book goes back to the very beginning of the CIA's covert operations. In fact, you say that early on, really, the Pentagon didn't want responsibility for covert operations. The State Department didn't want responsibility for covert operations. And the covert operations even had just a tenuous hook to the CIA early on. Why didn't anybody want it?
No state wants to be held responsible for dirty tricks, for blackmail or bugging or black bag jobs or all the black arts. Certainly not for so-called wet affairs, including assassination. What they want is what was became known as the doctrine of plausible deniability, which means that government can order up actions and dirty tricks, but the policymakers, particularly the president, want to be able to deny it, to say, hey, I had nothing to do with that. And that's why there is no paper trail at all leading to a lot of these plots. There's been a furious debate for two decades about whether or not various presidents authorized assassinations and other dirty tricks. The record is murky because nobody wrote this down and everybody's running for cover on it. My own view is that it worked this way, and I got this largely from talking to Bissell, who was the principal action officer here. A president would say something like, boy, that Castro, he's a bad guy. We got to get rid of him. Or he wouldn't even say we've got to get rid of him. He would say, that Castro, he's an awful guy. His national security advisor would say, yeah, we got to take strong measures. That was all the license that the CIA needed in those days to begin concrete plotting, assassination plotting, or psychological warfare to humiliate and discredit a foreign leader. They did not need explicit authorization. And this goes back to the question of their character and their worldview. These were supremely confident men who believed they could do whatever they wanted. They didn't need a whole lot of... They weren't scared or timid bureaucrats. They didn't need to cover their own rear ends with memos or documents. They basically felt, hey, the president wants us to get rid of Castro, we will.
So you're confident that the presidents often didn't know what the CIA was up to?
Because they didn't want to know. I think the Kennedys certainly became aware that the CIA was messing around in this area. I don't think Eisenhower knew, but I'm guessing a little bit here. And there's a sort of a willful denial. I think that Eisenhower and Kennedy had a CIA precisely to do this kind of thing, and they didn't really want to know what the CIA was doing. It was willful.
Evan Thomas is the author of The Very Best Men, about the early days of the CIA. Thomas is the assistant managing editor of Newsweek. He'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Evan Thomas, author of the new book The Very Best Men, about the early days of the CIA and the men who ran the agency's covert operations. Since part of your book is about the culture of the CIA and how that culture was developed by people from an Ivy League background, a very privileged background, tell us something about Frank Wisner's background. He, again, was the head of the first post-war covert operations office.
Frank Wisner was a Mississippian of a special kind. His family built this little town in Mississippi, owned the town, built the library, the parks, the schools, everything. And he grew up sort of like the analogy would be to a young British lord, that he was a feudal society down there. And he was sent off, like a young gentleman should be, to the University of Virginia, where he also went to law school. And then he made his way to Wall Street. And he grew up with this great sense of privilege and also morality. I think one of the reasons why he went mad and shot himself was that he couldn't reconcile the sense of right and wrong he was taught as a boy with the kind of ambiguities and moral ambiguities he had to deal with as a CIA chieftain.
So he was somebody who grew up with people serving him. Wait, I mean, you say he didn't even dress himself. He had a maid to dress him.
Yeah, that's great detail. Well, he dressed himself in the morning by holding up his hands in his arms, and a black maid would put his clothes on. This gives
you
a certain sense
out?
Of entitlement.
Yeah, how'd you find that?
His niece told me this. I stayed with her down in Jean Lindsay down in Laurel, Mississippi. I went down there and visited the house where he grew up and talked to his various cousins and nephews and just tried to get a feel for his background.
When Frank Wisner headed covert operations, he would use the expression, the mighty Wurlitzer.
The mighty Wurlitzer.
What did he mean by that?
This is a giant organ that he could play all over the world to manipulate the world. The various components were psychological warfare, disinformation, planting newspaper articles to discredit the communists, handing out bribes to police chiefs or colonels in the army. It was this idea of America as this all-ruling force, but doing it secretly. Wisner would sit at his mighty Wurlitzer, hit all the keys and stops, and play pretty much any music he wanted. This was an illusion. It was a grandiose illusion. Wisner, in fact, was manic depressive, and I think he had this thought when he was on one of his highs.
Reading the CIA histories, did you get a sense of whether his mood affected his work?
Oh, I think so. I can't get into his brain chemistry, but there was certainly an element of manic high, of grandiose ambition about his plots. He wanted to, he wanted to overthrow the communist government of Albania, and he kept parachuting in agents and sending them arms long after it was clear that all of these agents had been turned by the security service in Albania and were actually spying for the communists. It was just one prolonged disaster, but he sort of couldn't stop himself. He just kept believing that it was all going to work out in the end. When it didn't, it was crushing to him. His downfall came in Hungary in 1956. After all these years of trying to stir up a revolution behind the Iron Curtain, the Hungarians actually did revolt in 1956. Wisner went out there. The problem was that the United States, having gotten the Hungarians on their tippy toes, were not about to go in and really intervene and really give them arms because the Eisenhower administration didn't want to start World War III. So Wisner went out there, standing on the border as all these Hungarian refugees are streaming across, and they would say, well, you know, where are the American parachutists? Where are the tanks? Where are the supplies? All we saw were Russian tanks. And it was many people died in the very fierce Russian crackdown. There was no help from the United States. And this was a humiliating, crushing experience for Wisner. He became basically blithering after several days of this. There was a scene that the Rome station chief told me about of him going to see when he went to Rome after this, going to see Claire Booth Luce, who was then the American ambassador to Rome, and Wisner just broke down and wept with her.
Is that part of the reason why he left covert operations?
He was finally basically drummed out. He went mad and became utterly irrational, started making no sense. There is one story I don't believe is true, that they took him out in a straitjacket, but it is definitely true that CIA doctors had to escort him out of the CIA and to a mental hospital in Baltimore, where he was given shock therapy, became increasingly depressed, and finally shot himself.
Was that covered up? It's a frightening thought that the person heading covert operations was going mad and needed shock therapy.
I mean, can you imagine the headlines today on NPR or on the New York Times if the head of the clandestine service had gone mad and needed shock therapy? But that was a different era. The press didn't poke around on that. Some reporters knew about it. Joe Alsop knew about it. But he was protective. Frank Wisner was his friend. The press was much more protective. Congress was very much hands-off. It was just a different era.
Was the CIA shaken up by that?
Oh, sure. It was, I mean, cataclysmic. You can imagine what it was like to see your boss be essentially carried out as a nut. They closed ranks. Richard Helms, who later became the director of Central Intelligence and was a much more careful and bureaucratic figure, basically pulled things together for a couple of years, or for about a year. But, you know, the CIA kept barreling right along. The next head of the clandestine service was Richard Bissell, the fellow who hired the mafia. So it slowed them down for about a step, but basically they resumed their tremendously ambitious aims abroad, and the next great step was the Bay of Pigs, which was, as you know, a disaster.
Evan Thomas is my guest. He's the author of the book, The Very Best Men, Four Who Dared the Early Years of the CIA. And it focuses on about 15 years' worth of covert operations in the CIA and the men responsible for them. Your book is in part about the culture of the CIA. How would you compare the culture now with the culture of the 50s and 60s, the period you write about?
There is some overhang. The preppies are gone. You won't find too many Groton or Yale boys in the CIA today. They're mostly state school, more middle-class types. But the culture of secrecy and elitism does live on. And one of the reasons why the CIA got themselves in trouble with Aldrich Ames was they were so insular, so unto themselves, that they really couldn't see that they had a mole in their midst. And they didn't want anybody sort of looking over the wall to examine them, and that insularity was fatal in the case of Ames. That is a hangover from the old days. The social graces have gone, but the sort of sense of clubbiness remains.
Your book is largely based on the access that you had to CIA histories written by CIA men, and you were the first journalist to get access to these. Will other journalists have access to them now?
No, the CIA is very ad hoc and arbitrary. It took me 2 years and many thousands of dollars in legal fees to work out the arrangement that I did. And my the officer over there was handling me when it was over said, we are never, ever going to do this again. It was just too hard, too painstaking. I think what will happen over time is they will gradually declassify big chunks of information and that will come out. Other historians can try to go my route, and they hope they do, but they should know that it's expensive and it's difficult, and the CIA is, you know, hard to deal with, and they won't get everything they want or won't even get close to everything they want. I think the best hope is that the executive branch, that the president pushes the CIA and Congress pushes the CIA to just declassify great chunks of documents. You know, the truth is there are no secrets in them anymore that would harm the national security. And in fact, the most important wedge I used to get what I did get was that, just that statement. There's nothing in here to harm the national security. And that's true. This is, the Cold War's over. This happened a long time ago. However, the tradition of secrecy dies hard, and the CIA doesn't want to give up its secrets.
What are some of the questions you still have about the CIA?
Well, you know, I don't think we know everything. I know that Seymour Hersh is at work on a book where he's looking at Joe Kennedy. We may find that that President Kennedy, through his father, had ties to the mafia that also entangled the CIA. I think there may even be more here to learn. I like to think that it's all in my book, but I'm not naive enough about history to think that you can ever get it all in one gulp. I've gotten further than other historians because I had more access, and because these old spooks are talking at the end of their lives about their careers. But, you know, there are always more secrets out there. This is a spooky, weird world, and it won't shock me if we don't find even stranger things than trying to make Castro's beard fall out as time goes on.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Evan Thomas is the author of The Very Best Men, about the early days of the CIA. He's assistant managing editor and Washington bureau chief at Newsweek. This is Fresh Air.